Welcome to this ABC Radio National podcast. For more on other enjoyable and informative programs, listen after the end for details. But right now, here's your podcast, which we hope you enjoy.
Riddled with reasoning is one description of Anglicanism. Hello, I'm Rachel Kahn, and this is The Spirit of Things on ABC Radio National. The fact that the former General Secretary of the Anglican Church of Australia could say that about his church shows something else about the Anglicans. They can take themselves down a peg. They can see their own faults and reason out what they need to do about them. The Anglicans have had a lot to contend with in the almost 500 years since they began as the Church of England seceding from the Church of Rome. They've seen the rise of Protestantism and its numerous sectarian movements, the emancipation of Catholics and Jews in English society, and the rise of the evangelical movement. By the 19th century, the Church of England was accommodating a plurality of religious trends, including evangelical, Anglo-Catholic and liberal theologies. At the same time, it was managing its growing international church with all its ethnic and cultural variations. Later in the program, we'll get a world view of the Anglican Church from the Reverend Dr. Bruce Kay, the former General Secretary of the Anglican Church of Australia. Well, the Australian Anglican Church's decision to ordain women as bishops is a new development.
Anglican bishops from around the country attended today's ceremony to officially welcome Australia's second female Anglican bishop, Barbara Brinsley Darling, to the Diocese of Melbourne.
It certainly has not been an easy journey for women who, like Barbara, were called by God into ministry while the church was still debating and struggling with the issue of women's ordination.
The 60-year-old former teacher received rings, a pectoral cross and other gifts as symbols of friendship, love and hope before the Anglican Archbishop of Melbourne, Dr. Philip Freer, presented her to the congregation as a bishop. Bishop Darling has been the vicar at St James in Dandenong, providing support to the Sudanese community. Today, her local choir showed its appreciation.
That's from the consecration back in May of this year of my first guest today, Bishop Barbara Darling, now the second woman to be made a bishop in Australia. She's speaking to me from Melbourne. Bishop Barbara Darling, welcome to The Spirit of Things, and belated congratulations on being consecrated a bishop.
Thank you very much.
Well, in the 5 months that you took up your duties as assistant bishop in the Melbourne Diocese, how has your life altered?
My life's altered in many different ways. I've now got a new job, a new house, a new place where I'm living, new responsibilities, and I had the opportunity almost straight after being consecrated. I got ready to go to England and was very fortunate to go to several conferences, including the Lambeth Conference, which is the meeting every 10 years of the Anglican bishops.
Yes, so that meant you got to wear your new garb, your mitre, cope and stole?
Not the mitre and cope. There's various different regalia that bishops have, and we have what's called convocation robes, which is the rochet and the chemise, the red and the white. We wore those and also the purple cassocks, which we wore on the day what was called our London Day. We went in the morning and marched with the bishop's spouses, which included some men as well as some women, and many women. We went to London and marched for the Millennium Goals against poverty. We went to Lambeth Palace and had lunch there. That's where the Archbishop of Canterbury has his London residence. Then we went in coaches to Buckingham Palace wearing our cassocks, and it was a very hot day. And after that, the Australian contingent of about 35 of us also went to Westminster Abbey and had evensong and tea with the Dean. So that was a very special day. Sharing with many other bishops and their spouses.
Well, what a great way to begin your new life as a bishop. Have you received any pointers from the first woman bishop of Australia?
Yes, that's Kay Goldsworthy. Kay and I were able to be at the special conference it was on called Transfiguring Episcopate, which was for women leaders in England and throughout the world. And we met about another 10 bishops, women bishops, were able to be at that, and Kay and I were able to share there. And then again, we shared time together at Lambeth. But we haven't contacted each other much since then. I think we've both been very busy with our own responsibilities.
Well, I'd like to ask you about what they all are. But in the 16 years since you were ordained a priest, has the resistance to you as a female minister of the word subsided? Have people become acculturated to it?
It goes back much beyond that. I first came down and started to study at Ridley College in Melbourne in 1975. And in 1981, I was made what's called a trained woman worker. In 1986, a deacon. And in 1992, a priest. So I've been involved in ministry for many, many years. And over that time, wherever I've been, people have become used to women in ministry just through seeing us and through having us involved in ministry. So I think over the last 10 years, in Melbourne in particular, there's now a lot of women. I think there's over 80 women ordained as priests. And people in Melbourne Diocese are very much more used to having women involved in ministry.
Can you remember the first time you were preaching the word to a mixed audience?
I've had various responsibilities over my life. I grew up in Sydney and was very involved in the Interchurch Christian Fellowship and used to be involved in talks there. Then I went to a Script Union pioneer camp and was involved there. I went overseas representing the guides, and one of my first major talks that was a sermon was in Sydney Town Hall to the guides, what's called a guide zone. So it was mixed in that it was women and children, but it wasn't actually men. There were a couple of men there, but mostly for women and children. That was my first major sermon that I can remember. And apart from that, it was probably coming down here to Melbourne and studying in theology here. And then I began to preach both at Ridley College, where I was training, and then in some of the parishes that I was helping out at.
And what was it like when you first had men in the audience?
Mostly it was fine. I did have one incident at Ridley College when one person absented himself because he wasn't sure about women preaching. And another time where in the hymn before the actual sermon, a man got up and walked out because he wasn't sure about listening to a woman. That was rather disconcerting. But the support and the encouragement of the others, including our principal, the Reverend Dr. Leon Morris, and members of staff, they were always very supportive and very encouraging, which I found helpful.
How did you respond to critics who said, look, a priest is supposed to represent Jesus Christ, a man, and you're a woman?
We responded in various ways. That particular line of argument, if you followed it through, Jesus was also a Jew, and people who are in Christian ministry are not always from Jewish background. We believe that God transcends gender, that men and women are equal in God's sight. I'm not claiming to be Jesus himself. I don't think many priests would do that, but we claim to represent his love and faith extending out to others, and I believe that women can do that as well as men.
I think they probably can, yes. Well, does your calling and focus reflect your own origins?
I think so. I was a baby boomer born in the late 1940s, and when I was about 3 or 4, I went to Sunday school. I was at a large church in northern part of Sydney. There were about 400 or 500 people in the Sunday school, and it was very much a part of my life from way back, whenever I can remember, of knowing that the church was there, the Sunday school there, and God was there for me, and that God was calling me to be one of his children. And I was conscious of that. I didn't feel called necessarily to ordination. That was not a possibility at that time for women. But I felt called to follow God, to follow Christ, in the way that seemed to be appropriate.
I note that you've said somewhere that you felt the desire to be a Christian leader despite feelings of inadequacy. What do you mean? What sort of inadequacy were you feeling?
When I was going to church and Sunday school in the earlier days, as an Anglican, I was very comfortable with the prayers that were there. They're from the prayer book in those days, the Book of Common Prayer. But when I went to Interschool Christian Fellowship by ICF, there were girls there that were members of Baptist churches and Uniting churches and other denominations where they seemed very comfortable to be praying spontaneously, to make up their own prayers. And I felt inadequate with that because as a good Anglican, I prayed at home at night time in the morning, but not used to praying out loud in front of others. And that was quite an experience to realise that we could make up our own prayers. I think that was the feelings of inadequacy.
How do you feel about that now? Do you think that's a good direction to go into, you know, spontaneous prayers?
Oh, yes. I very much love the liturgy of the Anglican Church, but I also really appreciate the fact that we can turn to God and pray about anything and everything at any time. So I think we need a balance of both.
Well, where does your calling direct you specifically? I know this week on the Ark, I was speaking to Bishop Challen about the former Archbishop of Perth, Geoffrey Samble. He was very directed to practical measures to lift up society. He was very directed towards social welfare and became the director of the Brotherhood of St. Lawrence. I wonder, where does your calling direct you?
I'm very much somebody who's enjoyed being a teacher, right back from teaching Sunday school to littlies, and then as a high school teacher, and then teaching for many years at a theological college. And I really love the experience of being with people, of talking with people, of showing them the way forward, and of together working out new ways. And so I love anything to do with teaching and discussion groups, and also very much a people person. I enjoy listening to people, spiritual direction, encouraging people and supporting them. And I think that's helpful in my role, which is as Bishop for Diocesan Ministries. And in that, I deal particularly with those who are chaplains in schools, in criminal justice area, in health and hospital chaplains, in tertiary chaplains, with youth and children's and families ministries. So dealing with people who are themselves dealing with others in situations of need, in situations of growth, in situations of working out where Christianity is in their lives. And I really am energized by being with those people and hearing their stories and encouraging them.
Do you think that chaplaincy is a growing field in public institutions, including schools?
Certainly. It certainly has been in schools over the last year or so with the previous government's decision to fund school chaplains. And there are many more school chaplains now. They are in both state schools and they're also in private schools. And I think the schools that have the chaplains are finding that they're extremely valuable members of staff to be able to perhaps teach religious instruction or religious studies, but also to be there for the students in times of need and encouragement, and to be there for the staff, and to be there for families, particularly if there's difficulties, if there's a bereavement. The school chaplains have a very important and significant role, and in supporting the principals in their roles too.
Well, Bishop Barbara, you've said that preaching is a particular area that women do differently than men. What do you mean? What would be a good example of how women would read a scriptural passage differently from men?
It's very hard to make a blanket statement like that because women are very different themselves, amongst themselves, and as more and more women are preaching, we hear different kinds of sermons. But as an example, I know several women who preach not so much a linear sermon that goes from A to B to C, but they're more cyclical. They go around and look at things from different perspectives. Others are looking more at symbols. Others of us might use examples that are different from examples that men use. I very much like to use examples from people's lives, from the excitement of new birth, from people watching their young ones going off to school, for teenagers perhaps spreading their wings and moving out and trying new things, older people coming to terms with their aging process, to use very much things from within the person as well as situations outside and the world situation. So some women can approach things in a similar way to men, but I think we can add another dimension from our life experience and our interaction with others in a slightly different way.
That's Bishop Barbara Darling, who's been described by Archbishop Freer of Melbourne as a woman of deep faith as well as outstanding pastoral teaching and organisational ability. Well, I'd say she's got all bases covered there. We'll be returning to her in a moment. Later in the programme, Bruce Kay takes us on a world tour of Anglicanism. You're listening to The Spirit of Things on ABC Radio National and online at abc.net.au/rn/spiritofthings. And if you go to that website, you can download the programme or listen online, and in a week's time, read a transcript of it as well. Well, conflict is par for the course when it comes to any organisation, and the Anglican Church is no different. I asked Bishop Barbara about it. Well, this past year has seen the Anglican Church very conflicted about sexual and gender issues, with the Sydney Anglicans not going to the Lambeth Conference and having their own separate meeting with some of their international fellow travellers. So, Bishop Barbara, how does it feel to have been part of the movement that possibly will split up the church? Is it a heavy cross to bear?
I find it very sad that by responding to God's call, as other women do, that this is a cause for grief for some other people. That is something that saddens me. At the same time, I know it brings great joy to many people. And I was overwhelmed with people's support and encouragement when the announcement was made of my appointment. So there is a mixture there of sadness and also of joy at the same time. The issues that came up at the GAFCON conference in Jerusalem and at Lambeth weren't so much on women's ordination as on other areas of sexuality. And again, that is very sad that people cannot agree and have different ways of approaching the Bible and different ways of interpreting the Bible. What I found helpful at Lambeth was that we were in small groups. We were in Bible studies of about 8 people in the morning. Then we joined together with 5 Bible studies, so there were about 40 of us in a group. And there we were encouraged to talk about issues, including issues of sexuality, but that came in the second week, and to try and listen to where people were, their background, their culture, their understanding of Scripture. And in our group, we had the Sudanese Archbishop, the primate there, and several other Sudanese bishops, and also some American bishops from both the Episcopal Church and also from Canada. And it was very interesting to hear them listening to each other and talking and beginning to appreciate the differences and the different ways that they approached Scripture and what they believed were core Christian values. And I hope that we will be able to keep on going and to discuss this, that the people who went to GAFCON, the primates will come to the primates meeting. They will be able to talk with the Archbishop of Canterbury and the other primates as we seek to make some kind of covenant where we can agree, if you like, to disagree about some things, but to agree on the core things. And I think that as part of that, that women being made bishops to me is not core in the same way as us believing together in the Christian message. And we need to focus on the fact that what Christ has done for us and focus on that and try and come to agreement on that and agree to differ on other areas.
Well, I think you've just demonstrated what you've said somewhere, which is that you like to keep the peace and see both sides of an argument.
That's right. And sometimes that's difficult because sometimes you can't and sometimes you have to come out strongly against something if you believe that it is not right. But at the same time, if I do that, I'm also very aware of the people and the feelings that they have who may disagree with me.
Is that desire to be a mediator and to see both sides of the argument and to keep the peace, do you think that's more typically a female characteristic?
I'm not sure. I've seen it in some women, but I have seen it also in some men. So I'm not quite sure about that one.
2008, we've got Generation Y in their 30s. We've got surveys talking about how religion and belief and spirituality is changing in Australia and around the world. And I wonder whether you think that making the gospel relevant to Australians today is any harder than it was when you were young, given that in the 60s and 70s, sex, drugs and rock and roll were unleashed all at the same time.
Yes, I think each generation faces its own challenges. I think the established churches, like the Anglican and the Uniting, and perhaps to some extent the Catholic, are facing the fact that it is a different world for young people. Young people like to experience things. They like to have different kinds of music. They like to be together with lots of other young people. And some of our churches provide that, but some of the churches find it difficult to attract younger people. And I think we need to look at that carefully. But I think each generation, going back to our generation and generations before, we each have challenges, and I believe that the gospel can be relevant to each generation.
Well, I know that you're particularly interested in liturgy. You already mentioned that. And I wonder where you see some positive developments and ones that could take the Anglican Church further and perhaps reach more young people.
I think many churches, and I can only speak from experience here with Melbourne, but many are seeking to have traditional services on a Sunday morning, and they're also having perhaps family services, trying to have different generations worshipping together, and then they have services that are more attuned to younger people that are perhaps more informal. And I think we need to have a variety. We also need to try and have people of different ages coming together at times. So I think it's good that some of the really strong churches here in Melbourne have various different congregations. And I think that's tremendous. But we also need to be able to, at stages, come together as the whole to be able to see the strength in numbers and to have younger people having older people as models and mentors to help them. The other thing that I think is important too is the work being done in universities by various different Christian groups, including chaplains and other groups as well, to mentor and to disciple young people. I think that's a critical age there.
Well, recently on the Spirit of Things, I interviewed the abbot of the Taizé community, mm-hmm. and that's certainly been a popular movement for young people because of its emphasis on music and on music of the world and creating new prayers, new hymns. Do you think that's a way forward for the Anglican Church? Do you think it could take a few lessons from the Taizé community?
I certainly do. I've been to Taizé and I love that experience. I've also been to Iona and to the community there. And I think both of those communities have a lot to offer. We do have already in many Anglican churches Taizé services. Sometimes we combine with other churches from the neighbouring area and invite those who like the Taizé style to come along. And it's a very quiet, meditative service with the chanting. And it really attracts young people. What fascinated me when I went to Taizé was that there were young people, and there were thousands of them there, coming voluntarily to church half an hour early to get a space on the floor and staying when it had finished. They didn't want to leave. They wanted to just stay and be there in that atmosphere. And young people respond. They respond to music. They respond to candles. They respond to silence and to quietness. And it's not just young people, it's people of all ages, that we can use our whole senses, our sense of smell with the candle wax and of sight and of listening and of knowing God's presence in different ways. So I'd certainly try and support that movement.
And what does the Celtic tradition from the Iona community contribute?
I really love the Celtic tradition, and I think there's a part of me with Celtic background. I love the simplicity. I love the connection with God and nature, being on the island of Iona and knowing the roots going back to St. Columba, bringing the Christian message there. It just is a way of getting in touch with our ancestors and of knowing the spirit of God's presence there in that place, a very special place. And then again, to see the modern community that has developed in the old abbey and how, again, they are using that sense of space and of God's presence and of community and of liturgy to be relevant to the church today. Many of the Iona songs are now sung, certainly in Melbourne. They are often to very simple folk tunes, and the words are very meaningful. And I think that has a lot to add to our Christian tradition today.
Well, I guess the Iona community and its gorgeous setting is a long way from the day-to-day work that occupies you in Melbourne. Can you give me an idea of what your day constitutes or your week?
Certainly, but just before I do, let me say another type of singing that I love, which is available in my day too, is the choir singing Evensong in St. Paul's Cathedral. And that's another beautiful type of music.
It certainly is, yes.
Yes. Right, a typical day, it's more a typical week at the moment. I'm still getting used to my role. I've only really been the last 2 months actually coming into the cathedral buildings where my office is. I'm still getting to meet with members of staff to hear what they are doing. I meet with the person who's the coordinator for school chaplains, the person who's the coordinator for criminal justice chaplains, and the health chaplain people as well. Recently, I went out to Monash University and met with different people. The priest who's responsible is the coordinator for all university chaplains, and the health and wellbeing coordinator from Monash University, and talked with them and heard some of the issues that are happening at the university. I've been out to some of the schools. I hope to go to some more schools and also get involved with school services, some of which are in the cathedral and some are in their own local church or assembly hall. In the next week, I'm going out to visit all of the Chinese, particularly Chinese-speaking, Mandarin-speaking clergy, and I think lay people who are working as assistants, and we're having a Chinese lunch together, and I'm hearing some of their stories about the opportunities for ministry with Chinese-speaking people in Melbourne, as part of my role is looking at multicultural ministries. I'm also meeting with those who are the Sudanese. We have a large group of Sudanese-speaking people in Melbourne from various different communities or tribes, and I was quite involved with two of those in my previous church. So I meet with the archdeacon responsible for Sudanese ministry. Also, another part of my weekly work is looking after locums. That's finding people to go to different parishes when someone either is transferred from one parish to another or is on long service leave. And so part of that is working with my PA to organise locums. Also responsible for Anglican early childhood services and liaising with the people who care for the kindergartens. And also we have a full-time worker dealing with family and children's ministry, so I meet with her and meet from time to time with the whole staff in the diocesan ministries area and then meet with others individually. And then various different interviews and interactions with different people and meetings with the bishops and meetings each week with the archbishop one-on-one as well.
Gosh, it sounds like you haven't got a minute to yourself or to your wonderful dog, Becky.
She's finding life a little difficult adjusting to the fact that I'm out most days. When you're in a parish, you're often home at lunchtime and around that time. But with my new responsibilities, it's slightly different. The other thing I enjoy too is that many weekends I go out to different parishes. A lot of them have invited me to go and speak, to preach or to celebrate. And it's been great to go and visit those people. And just recently, I was able to go up to Gippsland and to a friend's place, and she is the priest, and she has a deacon who is a woman deacon. So for the first time in my experience, we had a woman bishop, a woman priest, and a woman deacon, and that was great fun.
I wanted to ask you finally, what's it like for you to be part of a church that does not wholly accept you? Are there any times in which you are really in a situation where it's quite uncomfortable for you?
I feel very sad that when I come back to Sydney to visit, and that's where I was born and grew up, that I would be accepted as a deacon, but not as a priest or a bishop. At the same time, I know that places within Sydney are also very supportive. My home parish has always been very supportive, and I know that the view that is held by the leadership in Sydney is not necessarily held by everybody else. But I do feel very sad that that is the case, and I feel sad for the women who are leaders in the church in Sydney who are maybe not able to exercise ministry fully.
Well, fortunately, the great response to you must alleviate that sadness somewhat. Bishop Barbara, it's been great having you on The Spirit of Things. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Rachel.
Bishop Barbara Darling of Melbourne, who's the second woman to be consecrated a bishop in Australia. And doesn't she sound on top of everything? A very organized mind, which is probably one of the most undervalued qualities today, it seems to me. Now, speaking of organized, my next guest on The Spirit of Things, the Reverend Dr. Bruce Kay, is another person who radiates this quality. It shows through his many books, including his Introduction to World Anglicanism, which is chock full of detailed information about one of the most complex churches in the world. And if he wasn't highly organized, I doubt if they would have let him serve for 10 years as the General Secretary of the Anglican Church from 1994 to 2004. But you can judge for yourself. Dr. Bruce Kay, welcome back to The Spirit of Things.
Thank you very much, Rachel.
Well, I can't think of anyone better positioned than you to give us a picture of how far the Anglican Church has spread worldwide.
It's certainly spread a long way. If one thinks of it as beginning in England, then it has spread to the British Isles, to Europe, and then to North America, to the whole of South America. It has spread to Asia, Japan, and from Japan to Korea, and of course to all of those pink bits on the map that we used to know 30 years ago. All of the British Commonwealth countries were places that Anglican missionaries and Anglican people went. So it covers almost the whole of the known world, except maybe it's very thin in Russia and that part of the Eastern European continent.
And was most of that laid down in the 19th century and fueled by empire?
It began in the 16th century and moved out with traders and travellers, and it came in several waves of empire, if you like, in the 18th century and then again in the 19th century. But a lot of it also started because local people evangelized after they had contact with missionaries or Christian people from England. So, for example, the earliest missionaries in Kenya were actually Africans. Two young men, Africans, had been taken as slaves by Arabian slave traders. The traders had been stopped by the British Navy. The Navy took these young boys to India, where they were educated in an Anglican school. They came back to Kenya as missionaries. Really, the Kenyan church is built on the work of these people. And in Korea, it came as a result of Anglicans going from Japan. There's a lot of movement from the ground, so to speak, laterally. Many of the people who became Anglican Christians in Nigeria did so as a result of missionary activity from released slaves in Sierra Leone. So it isn't just piggybacking on empire, though that certainly happened. There are a lot of other things going on as well. And that aspect of the story is now being retold much more vigorously and explicitly in the historical studies of Anglicanism.
Well, I wonder, how does the younger generation, the students in theological colleges, regard these colonial churches, if I can use that term? Do they see them as a resource for new thinking, new theologies?
Well, it depends on which theological colleges we're talking about. In Australia, the theological colleges, I think, only treat minimally these kinds of trends. They are beginning to emerge, And in Australia, I think Anglican theological students are concerned with what it means to be an Australian Anglican. And in a way, that's quite appropriate. In Africa, there is a clear movement to reshape the curriculum in the seminaries so that it takes more direct account of what one might call African Anglican identity. And so across Africa, especially in Western Africa, there is a restructuring of the curriculum going on. And that is part of the growth of national identity in these countries. Many of these countries have only begun to develop their national sense of history and identity, and that's reflected in what's going on in the theological colleges. In North America, there has always been an interest in Western Africa and in Asia and Latin America, and to some extent they are aware of those kinds of movements in the seminaries and encourage them. In England, I'm a little out of touch with the intimacies of the curriculum, but my experience there has been that they were interested in the missionary expansion, not so committed to interest in the indigenous growth of Anglican Christianity.
When you talk of, say, African identity, I would imagine it's a plural set of identities.
You're absolutely right. Africa is a construct, and it's very different. I mean, if we divide it roughly into East and Western Africa, for example, for the purposes of this question, there are many more tertiary institutions in Western Africa than there are in Eastern Africa, and that's reflected in the churches as well. And the institutions in Western Africa are more Western. They've been more influenced by European and North American considerations, and that's reflected in the seminaries as well. Whereas in Eastern Africa, more often than not, the seminary education has been related to more practical questions. They're training evangelists and catechists, the work in parishes and distantly located places. And they don't have the same kind of apparatus of what one might call Western academia. So there are differences. And then there are differences between North and South Africa. And then there is the influence of the different societies which evangelize different parts of these different countries, which influence the character of the church life there as well. So you're right, there is a multiplicity of diversity in Africa.
I wonder how that's changing some of the fundamental characteristics of Anglicanism, which I always think of as democratic and parliamentary in character. You even talk about, I think you say something like, the Anglicans are almost obsessed with reasoning.
Yes.
There's a lot of reasoning in the Anglican
yes.
Church. Well, how do these African cultures then shake up the Anglican
yes.
tradition?
Yes, they do very much. And it's a debate amongst the Africans. For example, in Australia and in Canada, where synodical government was really begun in Anglicanism in the late 18th, early 19th centuries, or the middle of the 19th century here in Australia,
you refer to the synods.
The synods, where you've got a kind of democratic governance structure. In Nigeria, for example, you have a synod, but the synod is divided into separate houses like the American Congress, and the bishops constitute a separate synod of bishops, and they meet on their own. And that synod of bishops appoints all the bishops in Nigeria. The local diocese doesn't have a say in it. They'd be consulted, but they don't actually make the appointments, whereas in Australia, for example, and in Canada and in the United States, it's the local group who democratically elect their bishops. In Nigeria, that's different. Now, I think there's a kind of cultural thing going on there, that there's a kind of residual tribal mentality, which is not inappropriate given the context. It seems to me it's perfectly reasonable to adjust in those terms.
Yes, although the Bishop of Tanzania, Simon Chiwanga, was quick to point out that there needs to be more democratic, more collaborative sorts of leadership, and he actually criticized the chieftain models of his culture, but also pointed to the monarchical tradition of the West.
Yes.
So obviously this this hangover of tribalism is disturbing some Africans.
It certainly is, and it comes from two sources, really. I remember asking a Ugandan Anglican why it was that their bishops appeared to look like members of the English House of Lords. They dressed like top people, and they were expected a great deal of respect, and they acted like big people. And he said, well, we learned it from the colonial church, that was the way English bishops were. But Simon Chiwanga's point is that actually there are also overlays of the old traditional tribalism. Tribal structures in Africa, of course, don't always correspond with the national borders, so it's a bit more complicated than that. But that reflects the character of the debate that is going on. And Simon Chiwanga is if I may put it this way, one of the more westernized of the African bishops. And so he's familiar with that kind of democratic tradition, and he's working within a system which has not always been democratic in the wider society quite in the way in which he would like.
Well, one African who's certainly progressed high in the rank of the church is the Archbishop of York, John Santamu, who made a very public and provocative protest against the church on British TV about a year ago when he took it to task for not standing up to Mugabe's regime in Zimbabwe. And as a mark of protest, he cut up his dog collar, which probably would have upset a great many people in the church. What was behind that? Was he just performing for the media, or was that an African thing to do?
In some ways it was. Bishop Holloway from Edinburgh at the Lambeth conference before last said that the bishops at Lambeth ought to give up their pretenses and throw their mitres in the Thames, which is a kind of similar kind of gesture in a way. There is a long-standing tradition within the Bible of tearing your clothes to indicate dismay and protest and grief.
Indeed, to rent your clothes is a traditional thing to do when you're in mourning.
That's right. And I think that there probably were connotations of that. The Archbishop of York is Ugandan and has a long experience of African politics and society and feels, therefore, very strongly the issues in regard to Mr. Mugabe. And from my point of view, I have a lot of sympathy with what he was saying. It seems to me curious that the African church has been slow to respond to Mr. Mugabe. Now, there are a lot of issues there. He is a liberation hero of the decolonization period. So you have to have some sense of respect for that, but not for what he's currently doing, of course.
We need the world to unite against Mugabe, really, and his regime. You know, the identity has destroyed. You see, as an African, as an Anglican, this is what I wear to identify myself, that I'm a clergyman. Do you know what Mugabe has done? He's taken people's identity and literally, if you don't mind, cut it to pieces. This is what he's actually done to a lot of, and in the end, there's nothing. So as far as I'm concerned, from now on, I'm not going to wear a dog collar until Mugabe's gone.
My goodness.
Archbishop Santamu of York in England on British television in late 2007, cutting up his clerical collar in protest against his own church's lack of censure of President Mugabe of Zimbabwe. I think it took the British presenter by surprise, don't you? This is The Spirit of Things on ABC Radio National, having a look at the worldwide Anglican Church and the challenges it faces at present and into the future. Just what will it look like in 30 years' time? The Reverend Dr. Bruce Kay is willing to speculate later in our conversation. Well, what is the experience of the Anglican Church in South America? Because most of us hear about the Pentecostals and the Roman Catholics and very rarely hear about the Anglicans.
Yes, they're a small group. They're mostly in Central America, but they're a small group in South America, and they stretch down through most of the countries, and they constitute a kind of small protest group in a way. They have been mainly evangelized from the United States, with some considerable work being done in Chile and other places from England. So it tends to be fairly cross-sectional in terms of church style, but fairly small.
And would they be largely evangelical, or how is the evangelical stream of the Anglican Church faring worldwide?
There is a fair bit of evangelical tradition in South America, but it's not uniformly so. In Africa, there is a strong evangelical tradition in Nigeria, of course, and elsewhere, and there are large parts of Africa, East Africa, which were touched by the East African Revival, which have an evangelical kind of character to them. The East African Revival was I suppose we would call a charismatic type revival, which developed in East Africa and has had quite a significant influence on the church in Tanzania and Kenya, for example, and of course Uganda.
And when was that?
100 years ago, and been running for a long time. And there are lots of connections between the East African Revival churches and the Australian church, because Australian CMS has a deep involvement in East Africa.
CMS being the Church Missionary Society.
And there's quite a little traffic between East Africa and Australia. People come here to study, And some of the leaders of the East African Revival came to Australia and conducted evangelistic outreach missions in amongst Australian Aboriginal people, particularly in the north of Australia. The evangelical revival amongst Australian Aborigines has got connections with the East African Revival.
That's very interesting. Did any of them stay here and settle?
No, they visited and went.
Well, I was just talking to Bishop Barbara Darling of Melbourne and thinking at the time that it was actually in Hong Kong where the first woman was ordained in the Anglican Church back in 1944. Now, that caused a furor, didn't it?
It did. It did. She, of course, was ordained by the bishop in order to take care of a parish during the war. And the Lambeth Conference after the war really reacted very badly to the proposal, and she withdrew. Her bishop was threatened with some kind of sanctions from the Archbishop of Canterbury in reasonably disgraceful terms. And in order to avoid him being acted against, she withdrew her ministry until much later when the Anglican Consultative Council met in Africa and encouraged her to go ahead and him to go ahead. It's not a good story, actually, her experience. In fact, it's a really poor story.
Did the modernizing spirit evident then in Hong Kong continue in the Anglican churches of Asia?
Not especially, I don't think, no. These were special circumstances, and it reflected a willingness to be flexible in special circumstances, which I don't think has flourished.
So there hasn't been an ordination of women in Hong Kong? I thought there was
in the
1970s. Oh, yes,
much later. I think that's right, yes.
How would the Anglican churches worldwide line up today on the issue of women bishops?
They would be divided. There are women bishops in North America, of course, in Europe and in Australia and New Zealand and Canada. But there aren't, I think, any that I'm aware of in Asia and nor in Africa. There are women clergy in a number of African churches, in Uganda, for example, but I think no bishops as yet.
And do you think they're implacably imposed, or is it are they divided themselves in those countries on those issues?
There are two things at play, I think, Rachel. Firstly, there is what you might call social conservatism, the cultural issues that are not sympathetic to women being in prominent or influential positions in society and the church as being part of that. And then secondly, there is a what you might call a dispositional or theological consideration where evangelicals in some parts of the Anglican Communion have taken a very strong view against the idea of having women in leadership positions, exemplified in the Diocese of Sydney here in Australia under a doctrine of male headship. There's that at play as well in some of these countries.
Well, you've said in your book, An Introduction to World Anglicanism, that in a sense the church is on a pilgrimage. Now, is that a cultural pilgrimage from an originally Celtic church to one that's now global and multicultural, or is it another kind of pilgrimage, a theological one?
I think it's both of those, really. There is that kind of Celtic heritage, but I think Anglicanism split in a way from a tradition of centralizing forces in the 11th century. And English Christianity stayed at a kind of local focus, whereas the Roman Catholic Church developed in a more centralized international way. So it calls itself the Roman Catholic Church, meaning it's a church, it's an international church, whereas the Anglicans call themselves a communion. They're a fellowship of local churches. And that's a kind of long-standing tradition. And what it reflects also is that Anglicans have less ultimate commitments to institutional structures which are definitive. We are habitually committed to certain institutional traditions, three orders of ministry and so forth. And there are within Anglicanism ranges of views as to how far we are committed to that and in what way and on what basis, but not in the same way in which is the case in the institutional structures of the Roman Catholic tradition. That means that Anglicanism is always, in a way, theologically open-ended. It's a bit more porous as a tradition, and that's one of the reasons why it's a bit more local.
Yes, I get the sense that it's more continuous with its local culture and local setting.
That's right, and I think as well it means that you have got to somehow be prepared to explore and therefore be on a pilgrimage. So the notion of having definitive answers to particular questions has been a much narrower or more constrained area of theological decision-making in Anglicanism than, say, in Roman Catholicism or even in Orthodoxy?
Well, when I think of the distinguishing feature of the Anglican Church, the first thing that comes to mind is always the way it manages to hold together different streams of tradition, the high, the low, the Anglo-Catholic evangelical, strictly male priests versus ordained women and bishops. Is the ecclesiology of the Anglican Church its Achilles heel or its genius?
Both those things, I think. The challenge in Anglicanism is almost always to find coherence and relationship. There is in Anglicanism what I would call a spirit of Catholicity and a particular form of it. Catholicity means the degree to which or the way in which the local Christian community relates to the wider or other local Christian communities and therefore the wider Christian body. And in Anglicanism, that begins with the local. So there is a kind of bottom-up kind of character to this Catholicism. And therefore it looks like it's more open-ended, and that this bottom-up Catholicism is often confused with being comprehensive and anything goes. It's not like that at all, actually. It's about dynamic interactions. And that's a little different from saying that the big global group is the Catholic Church to which the parts belong. That's a quite different model. And the Anglican model is bottom-up, but bottom-up necessarily connected to the other. Now, that's much harder to work.
And it inevitably causes friction, and that's what a lot of people fasten on to, particularly media journalists. But is that friction a good or a bad thing? Some people see it as the sign of imminent collapse.
Yes. No, I don't. Conflict has been there since the beginning. Peter and Paul had an outrageous disagreement in public over an issue of dining rights. When Paul wrote to the Philippian church, he named a few people who needed to get on with each other. Conflict is endemic when you involve yourself in a religious faith which calls for absolute commitment to Jesus Christ while at the same time calling you to stay where you are. And that conflict is not a sign of collapse, it's a sign of life. The sign of collapse is when that conflict is handled with animus and hostility and anger. In other words, in the absence of the Christian virtues of humility and an openness to learn and respect for others and generosity as you pursue your own pilgrimage, trying to find your way as an Anglican Christian in the world in which you live. And the problem with the conflicts in the church, in the Anglican communion at the moment, is really, I think, not so much that there is disagreement, but that the manner of the disagreement and the terms on which people portray the disagreement is really less than satisfactory.
I want to ask you if you can cast your mind forward 30 years. What will the church look like?
That's a very interesting question, Rachel. I suspect that it will be more disaggregated, it will be more diverse, and there'll be more institutions around, and there'll be different kinds of institutions. There'll be more like networks. How far we will still be observing territorial dioceses in the same way in which we do now, I think is open to question. How we view them will be, I think, different. And I think that the general kind of sense of the nature of Anglicanism will be much more diverse, and the struggle to sustain connection will be much more multifaceted and going on with many more different channels of activity.
Reverend Dr. Bruce Kay, it's always fascinating to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Rachel. It's nice to be here.
Anglicans are changing with the times, but that doesn't mean the church's essential message has changed, and I think that's what the Reverend Bruce Kay and Bishop Barbara Darling are really saying. Well, that'll prompt a few emails and letters, I'm sure, and you can have your say by going to our website at abc.net.au/rn/spiritofthings. Bruce Kay's book is An Introduction to World Anglicanism. The program was produced by me and Jeff Wood, with sound engineering by Anne-Marie de Bettencourt. Next week, the Year of Festivals brings you the celebration of Advent, a very important time on the Lutheran calendar, and we'll hear from another woman priest, this time from the Church of Sweden. They'll be putting stars in their windows in Stockholm, and you'll find out why next week on the Year of Festivals on The Spirit of Things with me, Rachel Conn.
Thanks for listening to this Radio National podcast. And now you've got a chance to have your voice heard on Radio National's Encounter program by going to Radio National's new online site, Pool, where audiences become makers. The Spirit Shift Project asks if your spirit has been moved while you're on a journey. While on your travels, has a place or a person or a situation shaken up your religious direction or initiated you on a spiritual path? We'd love to hear how you've been changed by an unexpected shift of your spirit. The best contributions will also be featured on the Encounter website or broadcast in a program. For all the details, go to pool.org.au and look for Spirit Shift.